The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today has worked as a political consultant, business leader, entrepreneur and charity trustee. Her involvement in political consultancy dates back to 1987 when she worked alongside Peter Mandelson and Philip Gould to create Labour's shadow communications agency for Neil Kinnock. In 1992, she co-founded Opinion Leader Research, now one of the UK's top research and engagement consultancies. She later advised Tony Blair in the run-up to the 1997 general election and became the chief pollster for Gordon Brown during his tenure as Chancellor of the Exchequer and later as Prime Minister. In 2021, she was appointed Director of Strategy for Keir Starmer and was instrumental in securing Labour's victory last year. In February, she took up a seat in the House of Lords, having been nominated for a life peerage. My guest today is Deborah Mattinson. Deborah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
We begin with the same question, which is, was yours a happy childhood? You were born in Darlington, County Durham.
Yes, it was a very happy childhood. I was born in Darlington and lived there until I was about eight. And then we moved around a lot. My dad worked in financial services, initially for Barclays Bank. And the way you got promotion in those days was to move. And we moved every 2 years, 2 or 3 years in my childhood. So I went to kind of four primary schools in as many years. And then in the end, my dad set up his own business after we'd moved to Manchester. So we then stayed there from the age of 12. I was there until I went to university. But yeah, very happy childhood.
And did you like it when you got to stay put for a while?
I did, but actually I also got very used to looking at a new sea of faces and knowing that it would kind of be okay. I got very used to that, as I think children are very adaptable. You know, if you've got a secure family behind you, then you feel fine about moving around. But it's sort of, I've often reflected in the last few weeks, it sort of stood me in good stead for looking at the sea of faces in the House of Lords. Everybody says it's like going to a new school, and it is, and I guess I'm quite well equipped for that.
Now, your father was an insurance broker. You went on to study law at university. Was there much party politics in your house? Were you quite political?
There was loads. My dad was a paid-up member of the Tory party. I mean, quite active in local Tory politics. So I've often wondered what he would think of the Tory party as it currently is, because that's not his kind of politics.
But so who were the Tory leaders he admired?
So, well, back in the day, I think he quite liked Edward Heath. He definitely loved Mrs. Thatcher. So we had a lot of, you know, that was not my politics. I grew up loving politics because he loved politics.
Yeah.
Yes, I knew fairly early on. So we had a lot of tea time discussions, shall we say. But it was fine. It was all, I mean, basically he encouraged me to be interested in politics and to enjoy the jousting of politics. And I did.
Now, you studied at Bristol. Was that an enjoyable experience? Did you get involved with student politics or other societies or focus on work?
Yeah, I definitely didn't focus on work, I think it's fair to say. I studied law. And
you have
after
to focus on work, but it's law, no? It's pretty...
No, well, I just hated it. In fact, I'd originally applied to do politics and sociology. I think I kind of knew myself quite well. And then I did better in my A-levels than I'd expected. And my dad had been very keen for me to be a barrister. And I was very keen to please my dad. So I switched at the last minute and knew almost immediately it was a terrible disaster. And then I kept thinking it'll get better in the second year. And then it didn't. And by then I was halfway through and I just stuck with it and did a very mediocre degree.
Yeah, but your father was pleased.
Well, yeah, I mean, he wasn't in the end because I also then left law and went into advertising, which wasn't at all what he'd had in mind. So,
and you mentioned then moving into advertising. So can you just talk listeners through, I suppose, the career steps? Because I mentioned the political consultancy in the introduction.
Yeah. So I got a job as a graduate trainee with McCann, you know, one of the big American agencies. And I stayed there for a few years and I then went to another agency. I joined the Labour Party having actually not been, despite all the political background in my family, not been involved in student politics, not been very actively involved in politics. I joined the day after the 83 election. I was living in Battersea at the time and Alf Dubs was my MP. And when he discovered that I worked in advertising, he said, oh, can you do some leaflets for me? So I did. And that was sort of how, I mean, it was entirely by chance. I did some leaflets for Ad, working with colleagues in the agency I then worked for, and he was delighted. And he then said, oh, you know, the guy that I share an office with is involved with a group of people who are advising Labour nationally in their advertising. Would you like to meet them? And that was actually how I met Philip Gould and started working with him.
So you start working together. And I suppose, did you enjoy working in advertising? And was that the time of high parties, glamorous times in the advertising industry?
Yes, it was glam. We worked hard and played hard, I think it's fair to say. I did enjoy it, yes. But I mean, I was also very excited to move on to this next thing.
Would you say when you moved to Labour and obviously meet Philip Gould, it is less work hard, party hard, or is it still similar ethos?
Less partying. A lot less partying, but a lot of hard work. So I left advertising and Philip and I set up a consultancy. That was the first business I set up, because having seen my dad start to work for himself and then how much he enjoyed that, I'd kind of always known that I wanted to run my own business at some point and sort of do my own thing. And so that was the first time I did it, working with Philip. But it was very much with a purpose in mind, which was to advise Labour, as we did through 87 and 92.
And during that period, I mean, a tough period at points for the Labour Party, what were the kind of conversations going on behind closed doors? And also, Peter Manderson, I think, was also involved with that consultancy. Yes. What was that like?
Well, Peter was director of comms for Neil. So he was, I suppose, our client, actually. He was great. He was great to work with. He was very, very clear about what he wanted to achieve. And although we lost in 87, we always, I mean, the verdict was that we had won the campaign. Quite what that means when you lose, I'm not sure. But I mean, I think we did run a good campaign that was the beginning of Labour moving itself into a sort of new and different era. And it felt very exciting. And yeah, it was a very exciting time.
Yeah, because the Kinnock campaign, it obviously did feel it was going much in the right direction.
Yes, yeah.
Even when you look back on it now. Yeah. What do you think went wrong? Do you think it is the moment that everyone spoke about? He looked a little bit too presumptuous of victory.
What, the Sheffield rally and so forth? I don't know. I mean, I think it was a very, very, very big leap to make from where we'd been. It was a long project. And the reason why we formed the Shadow Communications Agency was because we couldn't get an advertising agency to work for Labour, because Labour was seen as so distant from business, so far away, that most good advertising agencies were worried all their clients would leave if they worked for Labour. And that was what we were dealing with. That was the situation we were in. It was honestly another world. And that spoke volumes, I think.
And that's really interesting. So you have that election loss. And then at that point, I suppose because you feel there's been so much progress made, is there still a little bit of a sense of optimism about what comes next? And when does it start to feel as though, you know, things are moving?
I think I always felt optimistic all the way through that period. But it was obviously going to be a long haul. And 1992 proved that to be the case. You know, I was not in the school of people who thought that we were going to win in 1992. The polls were wrong. They weren't very wrong. And all of our focus groups, all of our qualitative work was pretty damn clear that we weren't going to win. But I think I did feel it was a sort of, the project was doable, but it was still some way to go.
And obviously, 1997, very different.
Yes.
Often you speak to people in Labour and they will say, you know, just because historically Labour tends to lose more elections than they win them, they never quite believe it's going to happen. Did you start to think, you know, this is going to happen, and at what point?
So I used to go in every week and present a sort of polling summary to the strategy group at the time. Sometimes it was chaired by Gordon Brown, sometimes it was chaired by Peter Mandelson. Peter would always say, so are we going to win? And I'd get this sort of terrible hot and cold feeling. I mean, yes, the data was saying that we were going to win, but I found it very, very hard to sort of speak the words. I found the same actually last year. And on the night, on July the 4th, I felt like I was sort of having an out-of-body experience, really. I mean, again, all of the data had been so clear. Something extraordinary would have happened if we hadn't have won, but I still found it really hard to process.
Just on the polling point, I mean, moving from marketing to working in the consultancy to working on polling, how did you fall into it? Was it just a natural progression? And what have you found? We haven't really had many, and obviously we can describe you as many different things.
Yeah.
We don't have many pollsters on this podcast, right?
Yeah.
So I suppose for listeners, what that?
Yeah. So It's interesting, actually, because when I worked in advertising, the people who owned the insight, the kind of the data, were called planners. And I think if had I stayed in advertising, I probably, having been what they called an, you know, a kind of account manager, I would, so in other words, managing the client relationship, which I enjoyed, I think I would have switched into planning, because I could see the power of having the data and how impossible it was to construct a strategy without that data. And so when I moved into working in politics, and Philip did exactly the same, actually, because he had a very similar background to mine, I think we both sort of naturally gravitated towards owning and really understanding the insight, because only if you do that can you create the strategy that you need. And that, through my whole career, really, that's been the thing that has sort of, you know, being at the heart of it, is really understanding where the people that matter to whoever it is we're talking to are.
And I want to talk about Talking to a Brick Wall, which is a book before the more recent one. But I suppose just to that point earlier, you said about how, you know, in the Kinnock period, advertising agencies wouldn't work and so forth. Then obviously suddenly you have Tony Blair, Cool Britannia, in quite a short space of time. Was that quite a strange experience, or did it feel suddenly everyone wanted to, you know, be a part of it?
I think in a way, although it was a bit, well, was it such a short period of time? I think it was quite a gradual evolution. Yeah. I mean, I think Tony was a game changer, to be fair. Yeah. I think his leadership was transformational. You know, it just took us to a different place. And he was young and clever and charming, and, you know, he just was a very, very different sort of face of Labour, and everything flowed from that, I think.
And Talking to a Brick Wall is obviously after the 2010 election, but I wonder for listeners, you know, someone who's now an expert in all things focus groups, perhaps it's just really obvious things, but what are the telltale signs when you start to feel the mood is changing, maybe in a way that is less good for your team?
I mean, you get this from the qualitative before you get it from the numbers. That's the first thing I would say, which is why I would always, you know, have a very kind of regular drip feed of focus groups, because you do see the story emerging from those before it comes out of the numbers themselves. So it's the language people use. I mean, we used to do these things face-to-face. We now do them online. I mean, that was something that changed in the pandemic, and sort of we haven't looked back, because obviously you can cover a lot more ground. But in a way, there's no substitute for being in the room with people and looking at their body language when they're talking about your people and talking about the other side. Are they leaning forward? Are they sitting back? Are they, you know, and I think those are the sorts of things. So the vocabulary that people are using, the body language that they adopt when they talk about your candidate, is incredibly telling.
Often does it then fall to you to be the person to relay the message to the principal?
It does, yes.
So I remember this one, obviously, Gordon Brown, his wardrobe, all looking a bit smarter. What are some of the tougher conversations you have to have? And is it as simple as saying, well, that's what people think, or do you have to coach it a bit for egos?
I mean, obviously, if it's going to be very hurtful, then you would need to... You don't want to destroy your person and have them sort of in a little pile on the floor, and it needs to be constructive. So I would always try to make it... I mean, this is where the strategy flows on, because there's no point in just saying, well,
they think
you're shit. I mean, you know...
Dan, let's all go home.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be, here are some things that we can work on. Here are some things that they're seeing that they do like here. So I would always try to make it constructive and leading to some clear action points.
And I suppose before we get to more recent times, just before that 2010 election, do you think it was quite obvious that Labour were going to, you know, be heading to the wilderness? And was there a moment when that became clear to you?
I think it was obvious for a long time before that, to be honest, that Labour was not going to win. I mean, the only question in a way was, you know, could the Tories step up at that point? Because, you know, you do need both bits of that to work, to kind of win or lose.
And I think that Talking to a Brick Wall phrase is almost, if I think about how the Tories felt in the most recent election, and particularly how Rishi Sunak, as Prime Minister, trying to get people to listen to him, and just finding that there was little appetite, no one was really listening to the Conservative government by the end of it, no matter, you know, how bold on things they did to do. Can you relate to that a bit?
Yeah, and I mean, they were listening though, but what they were doing was... It's confirmation bias. So basically they've got in their heads that the Tories are a disaster zone, that Rishi Sunak is out of touch and doesn't get it. So if he does something that challenges that, they kind of tend not to notice it. But if he does something that confirms it, then they are tuning into it. So, which was why, obviously, the disastrous trip to Dunkirk was absolutely, you know, it confirmed what people already thought. So they noticed it and talked about it and almost talked about nothing else for about 10 days.
Now, when you obviously left Labour the first time around, not the party, but your role, did you think you were going to have a more relaxing time? Obviously, you were very busy with work, but what tempted you to really come back into the thick of it with Starmer in 2021?
So I wouldn't have dreamt of working for Labour in the Corbyn era. That was not going to be something that I would have been interested in doing. And I was also busy doing other things. But you know, other than that, I had sort of kept involved often in a quite a, you know, low-key way through that whole period. But in fact, what had happened when Keir won, I knew him slightly because we had some mutual friends. But actually, it was Rachel who first got in touch with me because I knew Rachel reasonably well. And when she was doing... Yes, Rachel Reeves. And when she was doing the Shadow Duchy of Chancellor job, you know, the COVID thing fell to her and I'd got a little bit involved in supporting what they were doing on that. She'd also got in touch with me when the Brexit vote was happening to sort of, yeah, I mean, I'd sort of done a note for her about where I think Labour would sensibly place themselves. And it was after that, actually, it was Rachel who called me and said, Keir is going to be hiring somebody to do this role and might I be interested? And after initially thinking, no, not really, I then ended up doing it.
Now, you became very well known during a time working for Keir Starmer for the hero voters.
Yes.
Can you explain what a hero voter is?
So when I started, the first thing that I saw was that Labour's messages weren't landing very clearly. And the reason for this was that they were sort of trying... Everybody talked very grandly about Labour's electoral coalition. This was a very, very wide spectrum from, you know, kind of progressives who may have voted for Corbyn, right through to people that we needed to win back who'd voted Tory. It was impossible to please all those people. You couldn't do it. So some choices had to be made. So the first thing that I did was to commission quite an extensive sort of segmentation study, segmenting the electorate to really understand who were the voters that absolutely we had to win. And they were basically people, often they might have been previous Labour voters, they might have been Tory, they often probably had voted Brexit, and they had felt that the Labour Party had abandoned them, not the other way around. The reason for calling them... So what we did was to really identify these people and really, really understand who they were. And the reason for calling them hero voters, I felt it was quite important to give them a name that wasn't just target voters or whatever. The hero thing was simply that, I mean, obviously in advertising you have hero brands and, you know, it's fairly common vocabulary. But actually I felt it was quite important for politicians to understand that they needed to really respect these people because they felt that they hadn't been respected. And it was very important to sort of think again and shift their attitude and really understand them.
And it definitely led to a feeling that a lot of policy was often directed. I think I remember in one commentary, Gary in the North or so forth, but, you know, there'd be like
Gary
a certain...
in the North.
I just remember people saying Labour aides would just talk about these anonymous voters that they felt lots of their policy was then being directed at. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And you get to election night. And did you feel that strategy had been really vindicated? Because if you look at that vote share, you know, it's you can debate, you know, but historically the vote share was not huge, yet the majority was very big for what it was, and particularly in those kind of leave voting seats, which would relate very closely to what you were talking about.
Yeah, and it was the opposite of what we'd done before, which was to pile up votes where we didn't need them. You know, so we had votes piling up in North London or, you know, that doesn't win you an election with the system. You have to work with the electoral system that you have.
Was that a tough message to land initially? Because obviously, if you think about some of those cities, as you say, where you can get high Labour votes, but it's not spread around, you need to be more targeted. And perhaps that means saying some of the things that grassroots is a little bit less comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yes. And people would say, well, is it a mistake to just solely focus on this quite narrow band of people? The truth was, I knew people wouldn't. I knew politicians wouldn't just. They would always also pay some attention to their comfort zone. But it was about shifting the emphasis. And in the end, I think that we were very disciplined and single-minded about it. And it worked.
Would you say you had a positive experience working for Keir Starmer? Because obviously one of the stories that would never go away would be the boys, and that idea was very heavily male office and so forth. Did you find that much as a senior female woman?
Well, I mean, I found it throughout my entire career as a, you know. I'm quite used to being the only woman in the room. It's not great, but, you know, it's not that unusual. In my career, it has been the case. But, I mean, Keir is not a particularly sort of laddish man, and I had senior female colleagues as well, Claire Ainslie, who you've had on this show, Holly Ridley, who you probably should get on the show, who's now General Secretary. You know, there were a lot of senior women, and of course, Rachel, Angela, a lot of the senior politicians were women. So I certainly didn't feel lonely.
Yeah. And felt those voices were heard.
They definitely were heard, yes, yes.
Did you always plan to step down at the time of the next election?
Yes. I mean, when I took the job on, sort of slightly reluctantly in a way, just feeling you know, if I could make a difference, I should try and make a difference. But I always had in mind that my job was to get Keir over the wire and into number 10, which, you know, actually, at the point where I started, we were 12 points behind in the polls. It's easy to forget. I mean, I was inundated with messages from people asking me if I was crazy. Why are you doing this? Why are you giving up your nice life to go and do this mad thing? But that was what I saw. And in fact, I had told Sue Gray, who was then chief of staff, sort of back in November, I think, before the election, so that she knew when she was doing her planning that that was what I wanted to do. And I told Keir, I think we went through a short phase where we thought an April election was possible. And I suddenly thought, gosh, I must make sure Keir knows this. So I did tell him then.
You mentioned Sue Gray. You and I are both in the House of Lords. Do you have a form of solidarity with one another as former Starmer members who are now recent members of the upper chamber?
There are quite a lot of new Labour peers, a large proportion of whom are women. I haven't done the numbers, I don't know exactly how many, but we all have a lot of solidarity with one another, actually. We're all new girls at school.
And I suppose looking at how the Labour government's doing now, I just wonder specifically on hero voters. Do you think the right things are being done, or I suppose put it a different way, do you think that voter group is still going to be on the side of Labour?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you have to constantly refine who your target voters are, because things change, and they have changed quite a lot. So, I mean, obviously I'm not working in it anymore, but I'm sure that the people that are have been updating it and changing it. My sense was that in the early days, there was a sort of lack of focus, which, I mean, has endlessly been discussed. We know about that. But I think that focus has been regained. And I think that there is a clear sense. I mean, obviously, it's different when you're in government. You are governing for the whole nation. And Keir is, I think, very clear that that is what he wants to do to the best of his ability. But, you know, the people that will be responsible, tasked with fighting the next election, I think will be very focused on an evolution of that group.
Yeah, and it feels as though there is more political precision at the moment.
There definitely is, yes, without doubt.
And on that, I mean, the Reform Party, back when you were doing this, I mean, they weren't really too high in the polls. And when they were, it looked like a bigger problem for the Tories initially.
Yeah, I mean, all our data was very, very clear. The MRPs that we were doing, sort of seat by seat, we identified a handful of seats where we could see that they were going to harm us, seats like Great Yarmouth, for example, which sadly, in other circumstances, we might have won. But the candidate there said he could sort of feel it ebbing away from him after Farage's announcement. But we could see very clearly that it wasn't really going to be a problem for us. It was going to be much more of a problem for the Tories.
And do you think that's potentially changed now, just in the sense we look at Reform and, and obviously you're no longer on Labour, but with your expertise of many years, what do you think the best kind of approach to that is for the left when you have something like Reform?
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know if you will have spotted, I imagine, the ads that have been running sort of over the weekend. Those, I think, are bang on. I mean, one of the things I find extraordinary is that Farage has got away with basically saying that he wants to privatise the NHS. And, you know, my sense is that knowing the voters that might be drawn to him and understanding why, if they knew that fact about him, then I think they might think again. And I think it's very sensible campaigning on the part of Labour to be doing that kind of ahead of the local elections, where, you know, there is an opportunity for Reform to take a vote share from us as well. And of course, the by-election.
Now, you've went on to advise the Progressive Policy Institute based in the US, which advised the Democratic Party in preparation for the US general election. Last year was a year of many elections. I think it was the most for some time. But obviously you had the UK election where in a way, Labour started to look a little bit like an outlier in terms of the left coming to power. And then you look at the American election. What do you think went wrong for the Democrats?
Gosh, I think that...
on this time-limited podcast. Yeah. I'm sure that's the kind of question we could do about a new series of.
So I did some work for PPI, focus group analysis of polling, ahead of the election, and then some after, then some quite recently since Trump has begun. And the last bit has not yet been sort of fully debriefed, but will be, and we should definitely share with you. But I think that basically people were unhappy with Biden. It was a change election, just like ours was a change election. And Harris had to present herself as the change, and she did not do that. And in essence, that was the problem. So people... their target voters, their hero voters, if you like, were feeling quite angry, were feeling that government wasn't working for them anymore. And I think Trump channeled that anger very effectively. And I think Harris didn't acknowledge it enough. And in fact, actually, you know, went on the record saying she wouldn't have changed anything, she wouldn't have done anything differently. That was a problem. That was a real problem. I think also, back to the learning from Labour, where we'd been very single-minded, you know, we'd realised we couldn't be all things to all people. I don't think the Democrats did that. And I think that in the last couple of weeks, Trump had sort of three core messages. They had about 200. It was a sort of scattergun that just wasn't working for them. So there were a lot of problems.
Now you're in the House of Lords. What are you planning to prioritise in terms of what you want to pursue there?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, I'm kind of getting my head around this very strange place and understanding how it works, not having had much to do with it at all. And it's got a lot of kind of... rules and regulations and particular ways of doing things. I'm just really trying to understand how I can most make a contribution. I want to do whatever I can to support Keir's government from there. And then I've got a couple of things that I'm, you know, I'm very interested in small businesses. I'm interested in women's issues. I'm interested in giving the electorate more of a voice. There are lots of different areas and I will, I think, decide over time, but I'm not going to kind of rush into anything. I will just... quietly get on and do what I'm asked to do.
But you've worked out your way around.
Sort of. I still get lost most days, I'd say. It is like a maze. It's just extraordinary. Even though I've worked in the Palace of Westminster for 3 years, and I was working for Keir, right over the other side in Lotto. I used to avoid going to the Lords.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm the other way around. Okay, yeah. Lotto, I definitely got the hang of Lotto. It's not very big, and I knew where to go and what to do. But I avoided going to the Lords because I would too often get lost if I was there. I'm just about, you know, I can find my way from the door into my office or from the tube into, yeah, I mean, I've got a few little routes now. And I'm very scared of diverting myself from them.
To this day, I can never, whenever they're a Labour leader of the opposition drinks, I have to just find people to take me. I just get in my head. I can't. Yes. I cannot do it. But just two final questions. I mean, you met Labour peers early on. You have your colleagues now. Do you have many friends from across the house? You know, other benches?
Yeah, I mean, it is, and it prides itself on being quite sort of civilised and, sort of people are good colleagues and you can work together in different ways. And certainly there are people that I've known over the years who are sitting on the other benches who I would hang out with. But yeah, I mean, I'm a Labour person in the end.
And then our final question on this podcast is, what is the worst advice you've ever been given, if you can remember?
Oh my goodness me. Probably keep quiet would be the worst advice, I think, which I think is... as a young girl, being told to shut up. That's the worst advice.
But you didn't listen.
No, I didn't listen. No, and I still don't.
Thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Pleasure.